This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. The idea is as old as the Bible. It's a simple human need, really, a desire to share your thoughts and values with those you love, even after death. These days, such documents are called ethical wills, and there are workshops and websites to help you write one. Advocates say it's a way to leave a more meaningful legacy to your family and friends, and some of the very wealthy are even finding ways to incorporate their values into traditional wills. But some also caution that ethical wills can sometimes be used as weapons, stirring anger and resentment among the living. Have you written an ethical will? And if so, why? Or have you been on the receiving end? Was it an experience you cherish or resent? Call us with your experiences. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul is Dr. Barry Baines. He is the Associate Medical Director of Hospice of Twin Cities in Minneapolis, and has written a book called Ethical Wills, Putting Your Values on Paper. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Dr. Bain.
Good afternoon, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now tell us, what exactly is an ethical will? How would you define it?
Yeah, the elevator speech that I usually like to use to capture this is that an ethical will is a way to record and share your values, beliefs, life's lessons, hopes for the future, love and forgiveness with family, friends, and community. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. As you had described in the opening, ethical wills are not new. They go back about 3,500 years, and there are certain scriptural references, actually quite a few of them, that support this concept.
What are some of the scriptural references, or what's the first scriptural reference?
Sure. The first one is generally regarded in the Hebrew Bible, and that would be Genesis chapter 49, when Jacob, one of the patriarchs before he dies, gathers his sons around the bedside and dispenses advice, blessings, instructions. But it's an interesting one to read. He also does level some criticism to a number of his sons. Moving on into the Christian Bible, John chapters 15 to 18 is another good example of Jesus before leaving his disciples before his death. Again, a similar formula for advice, commands, blessings.
But these were conversations before the person died. What we're really talking about is a written document that people would read after someone died now, right?
Well, historically, when ethical wills became, when there was a transition from the oral tradition where people would need to dispense it orally before death, it did become written documents as writing became more commonplace, and typically they were shared after death. Within the past probably 5 to 10 years, the whole tradition has been changing where people are writing ethical wills at many different life stages, at turning points in their life, as well as sharing it while they're still alive.
Why is it changing? You said in the last 5 years or so it's changing. What's happening now?
Yeah, certainly some big national events, things like 9/11, where I think people are put more in touch again with the unpredictability of life, not knowing exactly what's going to happen. And I think there's two demographic things that are going on. Number one is the large baby boomer generation whose parents are aging. And there's an obvious situation here where people are going to lose their parents, and they do want to capture those stories and values of their parents. And then baby boomers themselves, of which I'm a member of that cohort, as it were, really want to do more about leaving the spiritual legacy or a legacy of values for future generations moving forward.
How do you begin to work with somebody in writing an ethical will, actually writing this down?
Mm-hmm. Well, generally speaking, the most important aspect is having a driver of some kind. And usually people facing or experiencing challenging events or life situations, and it could be, again, on a national level, such as the national tragedy of 9/11, or it could be going through a significant transitional stage or turning point in one's life, of which there are many, getting married, having children, growing families, and then certainly middle age and beyond as a way to harvest life experience, hopefully convert that into wisdom. And then certainly at the end of life, where as you're approaching the end of life, you're probably more in touch with this transcendent quality of wanting to leave something behind for the future. So there needs to be this driver that will really encourage people and keep them motivated to go through this self-reflective process.
Now, you work with the dying. How does this kind of exercise become an important part of the process of dying?
Well, I think this idea of transcendence and also hope for the future is wrapped up with an ethical will. And to just tell a very short story of how I got interested and involved in ethical wills, during a time of our hospice rounds, our chaplain came in relating a story of a man in our program who was dying and told him that his suffering spiritually was extremely high because he felt he would die and there would be no trace that he was ever on the earth. And this just resonated with all of us on the team. And at that point, kind of the light bulb went on in my head, and I remembered reading about this tradition called an ethical will, where someone could leave something behind, and we hastily sketched out a way to have this man do this. And when the chaplain went back to this man and presented this idea of bequeathing values, because in this case this man wasn't very well off financially or educationally or occupationally, but he did have a family that he loved quite a bit, this man grabs onto this idea like a drowning person would grab a life preserver. And as soon as he was done going through and writing some of these things down, this idea that there would be no trace completely left him. He was totally at peace. And when our chaplain came back to report this, we were all just in awe at how powerful this could be. And it was helpful not only for this gentleman, but also for his family as well.
We are talking about ethical wills with Dr. Barry Baines. If you'd like to join the discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And, of course, you can send us an email at totn@npr.org. We're going to go to Carlos in Reno, Nevada right now. Hi, Carlos.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I have two questions. One of them is, I'm in my ninth decade, and I'm writing my ethical will. And my family is pretty much divided between saints and monsters. And I want to know, should I try to tell the truth or only the good side?
Good question, Dr. Baines.
Carlos, that's an excellent question. I think one needs to strike a balance. I've seen people who have attempted to try and sanitize their ethical will so much that when people read it, they really say, who was that person? That wasn't the person I knew. So I think one needs to achieve a balance in writing the ethical will. The other piece, though, is in how you do that. Certainly all of us, none of us are all saints, nor are we all monsters. And I think in perhaps sharing some of the regrets of things we did that may have hurt people is one way to clearly acknowledge that those things happened, and certainly asking forgiveness or expressing regrets. I think it does need to be a balance of things. Overall, I'll be honest with you, I tend to be more of an optimistic type person and feel that a lot of the contents of ethical wills have to do with what we've learned in life, and sometimes that's going through the school of hard knocks, but also the love that we have for other people and the things that we value. So I think there's a way to achieve that balance and have something that's generally genuine and reflective. Most often the ethical will is the voice of the heart, and certainly for people that are in your family, I think you'll get the sense that they really would be most appreciative of the things that you do capture in that.
All right, thanks for your call, Carlos. And now I'd like to bring another guest into the discussion. He is David Trickett, the founder of the Jefferson Circle, a conflict resolution company for families and organizations that's based in Fairfax, Virginia. And he is with me here in Studio 3A. Thanks for being with us.
It's a real pleasure.
And Mr. Trickett, I'd like you to address the question that we just heard from Carlos. He said his family is divided between saints and monsters. I imagine a number of people might think that about their families. And I know in your work in conflict resolution, you have often come across these ethical wills and do have some concerns about them. What are those concerns?
Well, several. One is highlighted, in fact, by Carlos's way of putting the issue. I learned long ago in grade school, when I was part of student body organizations, those who keep the record have unusual power. And in fact, in writing an instrument such as an ethical will, what we're doing is actually often projecting our perceptions of those in our family, not just ourselves. And that allows us to call some monsters and some saints. In fact, these instruments are really our story. They are the story that we are called to tell for others.
The individual who's...
Correct. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those stories get a little skewed because we sometimes tell a story about ourselves, our values, our beliefs, our convictions, that others in our family and our acquaintance would not recognize. There is a chance that we would somehow deceive ourselves and certainly attempt to pull the wool over the eyes of others. And those on the receiving end often say, that's not the Joe or the Sally that I knew. Another kind of thing that I find we do have concern about is that these instruments can sometimes be used to manipulate and control, whether at various life transition points or after death.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, these are just written almost like letters, I guess, from someone who has died. I mean, there is no obligation for anyone who receives this document to follow whatever guidelines are being recommended. What is the effect on the person who receives one of these?
Imagine the emotional impact of a person with whom you haven't yet resolved life issues, a parent, a spouse, a sibling, of receiving a missive. Sometimes I've seen these things illustrated almost like the medieval Book of Kells. Absolutely stunning illustration, calligraphy. Sometimes they're videos. Sometimes it even adds to the pain and the trauma to hear the voice over a tape. And what you're actually doing is being visited by that other party, no longer in your presence, perhaps, or at a different life stage, if still living. And it's not easy to disregard someone with whom you've had or have tried to have an intense relationship.
So what you would say that perhaps people should try and resolve whatever their issues are before death, rather than thinking about writing a document that's going to be left for someone else to read after they die?
What I have found is that one of the most important things that seems to be missing from an increasing number of families of different economic standing in this country and other developed nations is the very simple ritual of sharing the family story around the table at dinner. Increasingly few of us gather to talk about the day, to talk about what has transpired in school or at work, and as a result, we don't know each other in some really critical ways, and we sometimes then resort to the creation of instruments to tell one another what normally and in ages past might well have been an experience that we had in the course of daily living.
Dr. Baines, I want to, we're going to take a break shortly, and I want to get into greater detail with you about how you work with people on these ethical wills. But just very briefly before the break, are these issues that you're sensitive to in the work that you do on this?
Oh, definitely. And no tool is either all good or all bad. It's certainly everything has its dark side. And I think David outlined very well some of the dark sides. This idea of scripting, reaching out from the grave, blaming, can turn an ethical will into probably one of the most hurtful tools that are around, hurtful documents, because there is no recourse for that. That in part is why I think more people are sharing them while they're still alive. And I've seen, at least in my work, as having them open windows of opportunity of communication and healing.
That's interesting. We're talking about ethical wills today on Talk of the Nation. The number is 1-800-989-8255. My guests are Dr. Barry Baines and David Trickett, and we're going to continue this conversation after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about ethical wills, what they are and how they work. Have you written an ethical will or received one? Call and tell us about your experience. Our number, 800-989-8255. And you can send email to totn@npr.org. My guests are Dr. Barry Baines. He is the author of Ethical Wills, Putting Your Values on Paper, and David Trickett, founder of the Jefferson Circle, a conflict resolution organization for families and organizations. Just before the break, we were talking about the fact that many people now are choosing to write their ethical wills, but convey them to their families before their death. And Dr. David Trickett, you were saying that this fits into your idea of sharing of family stories.
Well, helping create a family story. Often I find when I work with family foundations or families of means who are trying to figure what does it mean to be this family with these responsibilities and assets, the creation of a family story beyond that of lore and of accidental, haphazard memory is a very significant enterprise that is closely related to what an ethical will represents for an individual. What it does do, if it works well, is to help multiple generations be involved together in a dialogue to create the identity of who our family is and what that means. And it has a very different kind of emotional impact than receiving, if you will, a letter from mm-hmm. someone who has recently departed the scene.
Okay, Dr. Baines, I have an email here from Rebecca in Illinois. She writes, I have a couple of questions about ethical wills. Is this a legal process? How is this different from journal writing or an individual deciding to sit down and write a dialogue to their loved ones? In other words, why would you pay someone to write your ethical will when you could do it yourself in a letter or journal or even record your words on tape? Maybe you can clarify some of those distinctions for
yes.
us.
Number one is I support Rebecca in the fact that writing an ethical will is something that I think most people can do given a little bit of initiative and resources. So the idea of hiring somebody to do that for you is not necessary, but is certainly one of the options that a person has. As far as where this goes with journal writing, I tend to think of ethical wills as part of a legacy continuum. And if you imagine ethical wills on the left-hand side of that continuum and perhaps put memoirs all the way on the right-hand side, certainly things like life story writing and journaling fits in on that continuum. All of these reflect a kind of legacy of the spirit. What I like about ethical wills in particular is that most of them tend to be short, and so from a standpoint of investment of energy and time, it might not be that great for a person. Although very often one of the approaches that I recommend, especially for people who journal, is to review their journal over time. You'll see common themes that emerge from that, from which can be distilled down into an ethical will. Regarding the legality, my understanding, I've always heard, is that legal wills have never been regarded as legal documents, and so they're distinctively different than either a legal will or last will and testament or a living will or what we call an advanced care directive or advanced care plan. Ethical wills are not considered to be legal.
Hmm. Let's go to another caller now, Marlo in Tallahassee, Florida. Marlo, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm an attorney in Tallahassee, and I've always encouraged my clients to understand that a last will and testament is a will and testament, and the will to devise property and a testament to share your hopes and aspirations for your family that you're leaving. And the ones that I remember most clearly, it was my partner's will that he wrote, and he said that I leave my Bible to my wife, praying she uses it more than I did, and my gun, praying she never uses it, and exhort my children to remember that education is an end and not a means.
So there was someone who did acknowledge his own weaknesses in his ethical will, I guess.
Well, and one of your guests was talking about just something for posterity. The good thing about putting your ethical will and your actual last will and testament is that it's recorded in the public records, and it certainly would be preserved.
All right. Thanks so much for your call.
Thanks. Bye.
Dr. Baines, I did want to go a little more into detail with you about you work with people on writing these, and I wonder how, mm-hmm. when you do work with people, has it ever happened that you've seen somebody starting to be perhaps dishonest with themselves as they're starting to write this, or starting to get manipulative, starting to be controlling? I mean, how do you help mm-hmm. people do this in a way that is not going to be hurtful, painful for yeah. their families?
Well, in a workshop setting that I usually kind of guide people through the process or facilitate that, on the front end, I do talk about kind of the negative aspects of ethical wills, that they can be used in that way. And quite frankly, I, you know, try to recommend that they don't use it in that hurtful way. I've encountered very few people who tend to use it in that way. Regarding how much of the items that are in there truly reflect on the person as they are, I don't know the people that well, but clearly what comes out, I've always been interested to see how core values that we all tend to share do come out with very common themes in ethical wills, and yet when people fill those in or embellish those with the stories, all of our stories and experiences are different. So how we arrive at that value being important, whether it be the family or education or being honest, having integrity, usually there are wonderful stories behind those. And that kind of really make them much, much more robust, and also make the ethical wills very unique in that regard. I've just had very, few experiences personally with people who are using it in that other kind of way. And, perhaps in the circle that David works with, which is with family conflict and resolution, that's more likely to come up. I basically take people through a process of guided exercises and then have them share within small groups overall, and then eventually putting together their material into what would be then a draft of an ethical will. I always say it's a process, not an event, and something that, especially if you write it when you're younger, you have an opportunity to add to it as you continue to grow and learn.
Let's take a call now from Ken in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I really want to commend Dr. Baines for what I think is really important work that he's doing. I wrote my ethical will almost by accident. After I'd written my last will and testament, I started to write down a list of instructions about where the life insurance policies could be found and the safe deposit box key. And then I began to talk about things like, I want you to know that I'm very proud to be your father. I want you to know I'm very grateful you agreed to be my wife, and to list all those sorts of things that are really more important than the money. And I found it was a much more emotional experience than I had anticipated. My daughter's 9 years old, so it's not really time for me to give her a written ethical will, but it's changed so much the way I interact with her on a day-to-day basis. We're talking about values and how to live your life as a part of our everyday communication, and it's been so valuable for me that I've begun to provide it to my clients as a package of in the package of services that I provide.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your call, Ken.
Thanks, Ken.
You're welcome.
And that brings me to our next guest, because we wanted to bring a legal voice into this discussion of ethical wills. So joining us now on the phone is Jeff Scroggin, an estate planning attorney who heads up the Georgia law firm Scroggin & Company. He's on vacation in the Florida Keys. So thanks very much for taking some time out of your vacation to be with us, Mr. Scroggin.
Thank you.
Now, as we've mentioned already, ethical wills have no legal status, but you're finding that some of the people that come to you for estate planning are asking about ethical wills. Is that right?
I think what we're seeing is people are increasingly addressing the issue of legacy. I think probably all of us hope to leave some kind of legacy behind. And one of the things that an ethical will does is it kind of forces you to deal with your own mortality and think through, what is the impact of that mortality. When people start doing that, they naturally get to the point of legacy, and then there's a whole series of thoughts and ideas and techniques and other opportunities that are available of how do they influence the legacy they leave behind.
What are some of the ways that are being developed, I guess, where a person can include something in their will that sort of, I guess, in a way, instructs or directs the way the people who are going to inherit their money will use it or may come to it to understand their values?
Well, I like what Dr. Bain said, is that an awful lot of the planning in this area is a continuum. It's not everybody's going to do the same thing. If you look at it as a continuum, on one side, you have things like ethical wills, journals, family statements of, you know, here's the things that are important. Here's my perceptions and my insights. At the other end of the perspective is going in and setting up structures that involve charitable legacies, where you're going in and providing family foundations, donor advised funds, various organizations like that, where the family is going to make decisions about where the charitable money is going to go, but ultimately they're not receiving the fundamental benefit that's inside that foundation, yet they're being involved in future legacy by that charitable approach. In between those two continuums is a whole series of what I call a restraint continuum, where you're providing either total ownership to the family assets or minimal ownership of the family assets and things like charitable structures. So there's a whole continuum of ideas largely built upon who the particular family is.
What is there's something called the Family Incentive Trust? What is that?
The Family Incentive Trust is something that we came up with a couple of years ago, and it basically addressed an issue that we started seeing come up more and more, where clients felt like they were caught in a trap between either giving substantially all of their assets to their family and potentially hurting them, or disinheriting them by giving the assets primarily to charity or through family foundations. What we started recognizing is maybe there's some middle ranges to this where what the clients desired could be achieved, but in a different kind of structure. And what the Family Incentive Trust normally is first of all provides a family safety net, that there's always a minimum level of help, not a lavish lifestyle by any stretch of the imagination, for basic educational, medical, long-term care, disability, destitute family members. Second, it creates a series of incentives. If you want to be educated, we'll make sure you're educated and we'll give you spending money during that time period. We'll provide for a mother to stay home with their children, various other benefits like that. And then last, it typically serves as a family investment bank where there's a capital source, if you will, that family members can go to and say, you know, I'd like to get a loan to start a family business. I want to be able to do something that allows me to grow my family's own wealth. That concept is very varied. I mean, there's a whole lot of different ways you approach it, but it's fundamentally a inheritance that is fundamentally restrained.
Okay, well, thanks so much for being with us. Jeff Scroggin is an estate planning attorney and president of Scroggin & Company. He spoke to us on the phone from Marathon Key in the Florida Keys. And I'm wondering, Dr. Baines, what you think of this idea of sort of tying ethical wills to the traditional kind of will.
Yeah, I've found over the past several years that one of the areas of groups of professionals most interested in ethical wills are estate planners and financial planners, with the idea of, again, our legal will or last will and testament generally tends to be a way to bequeath valuables. And there seems to be a little bit of a vacuum in not tying those in some way to a way to bequeath values. And very often, financial and estate planners now can use the ethical will to leverage a person's current success into lasting significance, or at least, at the very least, to customize an estate plan that kind of pulls this all together. So I see this as being actually an area that has been generating a tremendous amount of interest, especially, again, over the past couple of years.
Dr. Barry Baines,
a good idea.
Dr. Barry Baines is the author of Ethical Wills, Putting Your Values on Paper, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take a call now from Monica in San Francisco. Hi, Monica.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Good. I was listening to David Trickett, and he was talking about how people aren't sitting down at dinner and having conversations about family and stories. And I came from a family that did that. I mean, dinner was at 5:30 every evening. And my father wrote an ethical will, and my mother did not. And what I got from his ethical will is who he was as a man, as a person, which was so different than who he was necessarily as my father. I found out where certain ethics came from him. And when my mother passed, I didn't really have that opportunity. And I just wanted to say that that's one of the beautiful things about ethical wills, is they give you an opportunity to express yourself outside of a role instead of that role and be limited by that.
So it sounds like what you got from your father was something you cherished and wished perhaps that you had gotten something like that from your mother as well?
Oh, absolutely. My mother died when I was 15. And so to not have that part of her, though I have brothers and sisters who can tell me things, it still isn't the same as having it in her voice, in her writing. So I'm just really thankful for the ethical wills and the work that Barry Baines is doing and bringing this out. I'm fascinated by it and have been researching it myself. So.
Did your dad call it an ethical will, or was it just something?
Actually, what happened is it was one of those booklets that my sister made my father fill out for the grandchildren. But my father liked to write. So in it, there were some particular questions that really lend themselves to the topics that ethical wills do, such as, how do I want to be remembered? What would I like my grandchildren to know? So in those pieces, there were ethical will subjects. He also talked about how he loved his wife and what love meant to him. So those things, you know, I would never have gotten those at a dinner table.
That's interesting. Thanks so much for your call, Monica.
You're welcome, and thank you so much for this topic.
David Trickett, interesting what Monica said. She had the dinner table conversations, the family stories, and yet this meant a lot to her still.
Yes, I think it does. What I suspect she got was an understanding of the foundations that actually shaped the fiber, the character of her father, whom she did know and cherish by virtue of those relationships. She didn't know and cherish him apart from that context that was family, that included dinner table, but indeed much more.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense is, one of the things I was thinking about as she was describing this, is that any number of people over probably the last few hundred years have written something on the order of my life and times, and what a propitious day to be thinking about something called my life, because here in Washington, former President Clinton is in fact here, sort of selling his story.
That's a big ethical
yeah.
one. All right. Thanks so much for joining us today, David Trickett.
Pleasure.
David Trickett is the founder of the Jefferson Circle, a conflict resolution company for families and organizations based in Fairfax, Virginia. He joined me here today in Studio 3A. And Dr. Barry Baines, if you can sum it up in about 10 seconds, I'll give you the last word.
Okay. Ethical wills are something that are important. You can do it. And again, it's the most cherished gift you can leave. It's the gift of self. And when you receive one, it's also the most valuable gift you can receive.
Thanks so much, Dr. Baines. Dr. Barry Baines is the Associate Medical Director of Hospice of the Twin Cities in Minneapolis and author of Ethical Wills, Putting Your Values on Paper. He joined us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. When we come back from a short break, how soccer explains the world. No kidding. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.